Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on the oppression of women bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution. Now, this is an excerpt from the DVD talk, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. And before that, we'll be talking with Kay Buck, the CEO and executive director of the Coalition Against Slavery and Trafficking. And people remember last week on this show, we interviewed the filmmakers from the movie Sold, a powerful new film about the sexual slavery and trafficking of women and girls. So this week, we're going to be following up on this with this interview with Kay Buck, and we'll be going into detail on the scope and impact of human trafficking around the world and in the U.S. as well. But opening the show up, I had a chance to talk with Robbie Mirapol. Robbie's the son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And Robbie was in town last weekend, and we got a chance to talk about the whole framing up and execution of his parents during the McCarthy era and the campaign to exonerate Ethel Rosenberg. I'm not going to say any more because Robbie gets into it pretty powerfully in the interview. So let's just jump right into that. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my guest, Robbie Mirapol. Back in 1953, Robbie's parents were executed by the U.S. government. His parents were Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And Robbie is the founder of the Rosenberg Fund for Children, and he's the author of An Execution in the Family, and with his brother Michael Mirapol, also wrote We Are Your Sons. And right now, Robbie's here talking with us about a project that he's working on, which is an effort to exonerate his mother. So, Robbie, tell us about that.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure. The genesis of this project is, and I must say, well, I'm going to step back for a second and say that I founded the Rosenberg Fund for Children in 1990, and for 25 years almost, I was the executive director. And one of the things that the Rosenberg Fund is doing is this campaign to exonerate my mother.
Tell people who your parents were, because they said that the government had executed them. And that's really important for people to understand who your parents were and why did the government go after them.
Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were charged with, the technical charge was conspiracy to commit espionage. They actually weren't even charged with either espionage or treason, though that's often the way the case is treated. The object of this conspiracy, according to the government, was to steal what was called the secret of the atomic bomb and give it to the Soviet Union. This trial occurred at the height of the Korean War. It was tried in New York City, where the jurors were essentially told that these people on trial gave our arch enemy, the Soviet Union, the means to destroy you and your family. That's the atmosphere that it took place in. I guess I should say that I was 6 years old at the time of my parents' execution, three when they were arrested in 1950. My brother's 4 years older than me. And we were adopted by Abel and Ann Mirapol and changed our names and dropped from public sight. But in the 1970s, in the wake of the Watergate scandal and the strengthening of the Freedom of Information Act, we sued under the Freedom of Information Act and ultimately, in a 10-year effort, forced the release of several hundred thousand secret files. And that was the beginning of my understanding that the case against my father was different from the case against my mother. I found this frustrating, that we never really focused on my mother. It was always the Rosenbergs. But when they talked about the Rosenbergs, all they talked about was Julius. It was like Ethel was disappeared into Julius. And that became more and more important to me as we began to gather stuff from the files that indicated that there was no case against Ethel at all. We couldn't really pin it down until much more recently, and that was in 2008, the transcript of the grand jury testimony of Ruth Greenglass. Now, my parents had two chief accusers, David and Ruth Greenglass, my mother's younger brother and his wife. And they were offered a deal by the government. If you cooperate, David won't be executed, and Ruth, who had two kids just like my mother did, will stay out of jail. Now, my parents were offered the same deal and they refused, but the Greenglasses took the deal. So David and Ruth Greenglass testified that my mother was present at two key meetings in the fall of 1945, just after the end of World War II, and that David, who'd been an army sergeant working at Los Alamos where the bomb was being fabricated, provided at the key meeting in September of 1945 a cross-section of a sketch of the atomic bomb, and that Ethel was present and typed up the handwritten notes that David said accompanied his sketch. Now, first of all, this turns out to be a fabrication. But one of the amazing things about the case is, even if it were true, every word of it were true, and that was the only evidence presented against my mother at trial, that would mean that the government of the United States executed someone for typing. But it wasn't true. And the way we know this, not only from various researchers and files that we forced into the public eye, but when the grand jury transcript of Ruth Greenglass's testimony was released, she made no mention of these meetings, no mention of my mother's typing, no mention of my mother's involvement. So my brother and I both began to think, you know, maybe we should really do something about Ethel. In the meantime, however, my parents' co-defendant in 2008, Morton Sobel, admitted that he and Julius were involved in spying for the Soviet Union. This was not atomic espionage, but it was military-industrial espionage, and essentially they were engaged in an effort to help the Soviet Union defeat the Nazis during World War II. It was things like radar and aeronautics, so it wasn't necessarily penny ante, but it was not atomic espionage, which is what was used to justify the death penalty. So we knew from Ruth Greenglass's testimony, and we knew from Morton Sobel's admission, that Julius was guilty of some lesser crime, and Ethel wasn't guilty at all. 7 years later, the summer of 2015, the transcripts of David Greenglass's grand jury testimony were released. Now, the reason there's that year gap is that Ruth had died, and so it was released, and David died in 2014, and so it was released in 2015. And he categorically said to the grand jury, I never talked to my sister about it, and she didn't know anything about it, and she was not involved. So what we had was definitive statements under oath, contemporaneously transcribed, stated before a jury, that directly contradicted their sworn testimony at trial. So we knew that we could prove that the people who provided evidence against my mother were perjurers. And once we knew that, we said, well, we're going to ask the Obama administration to issue a proclamation before Obama leaves office asking that Ethel be exonerated because her conviction was based upon perjured testimony and therefore it should be thrown out. Because of the release of this material in July, we convinced the New York Times to publish an op-ed piece in which we asked for this, and that made a big splash. That was in August. Grand jury stuff was released in July, op-ed in August. In September, we got, based in part upon this new information, 13 members of the New York City Council and Manhattan's borough president to declare that Ethel's execution was wrongful and that an injustice had taken place in the Rosenberg case. So the momentum began to build, and it took us a while to get the technology in place to mount an online petition campaign. But early in March of this year, the Rosenberg Fund for Children launched this campaign, and as of today, my latest figures is we already have 5,300 signatures, and we hope to cross 10,000 soon, and we hope as we go through the summer and fall to build the pressure, and so after the election, when it comes time for presidents who are leaving office to do pardons, and this isn't a pardon, because you can't pardon someone who's not guilty, to do things like this. So we hope to continue to build and really reach a crescendo in late November, early December.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Robbie Mirapol. And Robbie is the founder of the Rosenberg Fund for Children and the author of An Execution in the Family. And along with his brother, Michael Mirapol, he also wrote We Are Your Sons. And he's right now, he's heading up an effort to exonerate his mom, Ethel Rosenberg, who was with her husband. They were murdered by the U.S. government in 1953, framed for being spies. Let me ask you this, because my reading of this, and it's been years that I've followed your mother and dad's case, and there was a certain atmosphere that is getting whipped up today, both with these fascists like Trump out there and all this other stuff, but it's in general, it's generally in this society, there's this sort of like witch hunt stuff that goes on. You know, right now it's aimed at Arab people and Muslims, and it attacks people on all kinds of levels. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I have been really, I mean, just really, really moved by is that when you talked about your mom and you said that, you know, she was not guilty of anything. And the thing is that, and your dad as well. I mean, look, you know, the fact that he was helping the Soviets defeat the Nazis and it was economic and whatever, it was a whole different category of material aid that he gave to the Soviet Union. And it was done on the basis of, look, these Nazis are what they are. They're Nazis and they're causing a great scourge on the world. And he wanted to do something to actually do it. And the Soviet Union was a bulwark of at the time, whatever weaknesses there were, it was also a bulwark to people around the world who sought some kind of
justice. Well, they lost 20 million people in the war.
Yeah, exactly. And so your dad stood up for that and your mom stood with him. Whether she did anything, you know, concrete or not, she stood with him. And both of them stood up against a horrible, horrible, I mean, just the atmosphere that was, you know, that was built up around their case. And I was reading something this morning about the response of the judge in the case who blamed your mom and dad for starting the Korean War. The response of Eisenhower when he was asked to review the case and make a ruling that would say, look, we got to pardon him or something. Mm-hmm. And he said, they're responsible for all future nuclear wars. Mm-hmm. And so they painted this like this satanic image. This was as bad as you could get. All of the things that got piled up on there. And they really did whip up this kind of atmosphere. That was just it was a horror. And I can't help but think that, you know, the impact that must have had in terms of what your mom and dad were able to do. Your mom and your dad never stood up and said, they didn't say, we didn't do this. They took the Fifth Amendment and they refused
to be. Well, they did proclaim their innocence, but the prosecution immediately said, were you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? That's when they took the Fifth Amendment. Yeah. If I could go back and change history, I kind of wish they wouldn't have, because it didn't do them any good. And they were members of the Communist Party. But that's 2020 hindsight.
I'm a communist today. I'm fine with it.
Well, so that's the truth, that they did stand up for their beliefs. The other thing that for me is another aspect of this is that my father, he had a college degree in electrical engineering, but he was not a real scientist, okay? Mm-hmm. What he was the recruiter. He gathered his friends. And my father, I will say that he had bad eyesight. He couldn't fight in the war. And perhaps if he had better eyesight, he would have entered the army and not done what he did. But this was his contribution to the war effort. He organized friends who were more scientifically trained people, who were graduate students, people who ultimately got PhDs. And the reason the FBI went after him was because he was the one who knew everybody else. But the people who he organized were not professional spies. They were political activists. They were his comrades, people from his neighborhood, people who were in the anti-fascist struggle together. And the reason my parents would not cooperate was two things. One, they weren't going to rat out their friends and political comrades. And two, they were being asked to lie. They weren't being asked, Julius wasn't being asked to admit what he did. He was being asked to say he stole the secret of the atomic bomb and these other people helped him. And he just wouldn't do that.
Yeah, this is the thing that stands out in a lot of ways around this case. And in particular, I keep thinking about your mom and her role in this in terms of the two of them were together and she didn't try and separate herself off. Mm-hmm. It took a lot of guts to do that, a lot of principle. And I keep thinking that the case was actually, it was woven with lies. Your uncle, the lies that he told that were just phenomenal. The one that stands out about the guy that he met, they couldn't even come up with the right name until the FBI sat them down and said, this is the name you should use, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That one of the things that is remarkable about my parents' case, because of the not complete success, but partial success of our Freedom of Information Act suit, there are still, by the way, at least 100,000 pages that the government of the United States has not released. Wow. Now, I don't think that material is going to substantially alter what we know. Mm-hmm. But they continue to exercise their power to keep the public from knowing, which is what I think is going on, rather than covering up anything, because I think the people who control the files don't even know what's in them, because the people who knew what were in them are long gone. It's over 60 years. So knowing that, getting all this material out, even though it's not complete, enabled us to show the lies, to demonstrate the lies. You know, this is not our accusation. We have an FBI file that shows how the witnesses were brought together to iron out discrepancies in their story. You can't find things like that in too many other cases. We also have files or notes taken from files that came out of the KGB for a few years at the end of Gorbachev's control of the government in the former Soviet Union. The KGB files were opened up and a researcher was able to go in and copy them, mm-hmm. make notes on them. Now, this guy is sort of politically suspect in my mind, but in the process of copying those notes, one of the things that became clear was that while David and Ruth Greenglass lied about a lot of things, they actually did engage in or tried to engage in espionage, and the KGB considered them agents. And the way we know this is anytime the KGB, the Russian, you know, secret police, the Russian spy network, recruited an agent, they gave them a code name. David and Ruth each had code names. Huh. They did not give a code name to Ethel. And the chief decryptor for the Americans who were trying to decipher the codes that they used concluded in his analysis that the reason that Ethel didn't have a code name was because she wasn't a spy. So the KGB didn't consider her a spy. The chief decryptor for the U.S. government didn't consider her a spy. And so we know that she wasn't a spy. Again, this is not subtle. This is not us making arguments. We have ironclad proof. And that's why we're mounting this campaign.
You know, when you think about it, when you look at what you just said, and the stuff that I read in just getting ready to talk with you, the fact that they knew, and they had decided that they would use your mother, that they would use your mother to get what they wanted to get. Look, it wasn't like they thought, well, really, you know, in the most bizarre fashion, well, really, we know that Julius is guilty. Mm. And he's guilty of doing all these heinous things. And the way we got to get him is to use his wife. They actually knew that both of them weren't what they said they were, what they were accused of being. And they took your mom, who they knew had nothing to do with this, really, in terms of, you know, essential. Mm. Nothing, there was no deep
well,
down.
Well, she probably supported politically, but she didn't actively do anything.
Right, right. But they knew that, and they used her and went against it, and they figured that they would be able to break your father by doing that, and that would give them the sacrifice they had.
Well, basically, they took my mother as a hostage.
Yeah.
And they held a gun to her head, figuratively, or the electric chair, the threat of the electric chair, and they said to Julius, we're going to kill her if you don't cooperate. And the CIA and the FBI were so certain that at the last minute my parents would cooperate because of the pressure that was brought to bear, that they actually created a list of questions to ask Julius. They didn't create a list of questions for Ethel, which I think is indicative of what they knew. And the sixth question on their list of questions to my father was your wife cognizant? They never use the word aware. They always use FBI speak. They always use the word people are cognizant. Was your wife, Ethel, cognizant of your activities? Not did she participate, but was she aware of them? That's almost a smoking gun. So again, I feel like I'm repeating myself a little, but there is a cadre of right-wing historians who are still trying to fight the Cold War, who are using snippets of information gleaned from KGB files to say, oh, Ethel really was a spy. And none of their material can be independently verified. And when you put that up against grand jury statements and the files and the evidence and the fact that she didn't have a code name, it's an extremely lopsided contest. But they don't care because they're still fighting the Cold War and they're doing something even, I think, more important in today's politics. You talked about the echoes of fascism and Nazism that we have today. There's also the echoes of political repression within the court system. So that ever since 9/11, the government, which in the 1950s had this very simple equation, There's an international communist conspiracy that's out to destroy us, and therefore the Bill of Rights and the Constitution have to be thrown out the window because otherwise the communists are going to sweep us away. Well, after 9/11, they pulled out the word communist, plugged in the word terrorist, and you have the same equation. So the courts can always play the national security card in attempting to round up people they don't like. As you say, it may be people who they call terrorists who are in the crosshairs today, but it can also be immigrants. It can also be anti-war protesters. It can also be environmentalists. It can be gay people. You know, you can go on and on and on. This kind of tactic can be used. So it's really important to show how it was misused in order to try to short circuit their efforts to employ these kind of tactics again.
Absolutely. Now, where do things stand with the effort to exonerate your mom right now?
Well, right now we have 5,300 signatures. We really have just gotten started. To some degree, you could say that we're sort of working out the technological bugs, but we've got things open. If you go online to the Rosenberg Fund for Children website, it's a very simple web address. It's www.rfc.org. The main page will open up, and right there in front of you will be the link to the campaign and also connections to supporting documents so you can look at the proof yourself. Again, it's very easy, and then there's a simple way to click and add your name. And we're also urging people, if they want to do it, to take selfies of themselves holding up signs saying, you know, I joined the Honor Exonerate Ethel campaign. That's really where we're at right now. And we will see how, you know, one of the reasons I'm here talking to you today is an effort to gather momentum for the campaign.
Now, I'm going to ask you this, which is if you were to just, you're put on a spot. The reason that your mom should be exonerated is what? Above and beyond everything else, what's the reason?
Well, you know, I, of course, have a personal stake in this. My brother and I feel very strongly about it. But it's also because if you look at this cadre of right-wing people who are trying to say, no, she really was a spy, what they're basically saying is, look, it's okay that the government committed these abuses. It's okay that they engineered the execution of someone in order to force someone else to cooperate. All of those things are okay because Ethel and Julius really were guilty. And that authoritarian mindset, which says, yeah, the government may have abused its power, but it did it in order to protect us. That is the overwhelming mindset that we find today from Guantanamo to the black site prisons all over the world, and the way our court system is cracking down on people who dissent. So the one reason is to make sure that what happened in the 1950s doesn't happen again. And it's worse than that because it is happening again and we have to combat it.
Absolutely. That's great. That's something that everyone should think about, take to heart and act on. Now, one last question. You've mentioned the Rosenberg Fund for Children. Let's talk about what that is.
Okay. The Rosenberg Fund for Children is a public foundation that I founded in 1990 to provide for the educational and emotional needs of the children of targeted activists and targeted activist youth in the United States. We're a public foundation, so we raise money and we give it away. We've given away over $5 million, I think it's gotten to $6 million worth of grants now in our 26-year history. We've helped over 1,000 children, and they are the children of people engaged in any sort of progressive activism you can think of. The Rosenberg Fund has four guiding principles. All people have equal worth. People are more important than profits. Society must function within ecologically sustainable limits, and world peace is a necessity. If you get in trouble promoting any one of those ideas or ideas of that nature, your children are eligible for support from the foundation.
That's great. That's really great. Robbie Maripol, thank you very much, man.
You're welcome.
All right, that was Robbie Maripol, the son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Okay, welcome back. That was Slave Song by David Murray. Last week, I brought you an interview I did with Jeffrey Brown and Jane Charles, director and producer of the film Sold, a really powerful film about the sex slavery and trafficking of girls and women around the world. And this film is now playing in many cities, and I want to encourage people all over the country to go and see it. It's a very important, very moving, very heavy film, all right? And in relation to this, I wanted to do something that gets into the question a little bit deeper than we were able to do last week. So as part of that, I wanted to talk with someone who knew a lot about what's going on in trafficking, what's behind it, what's happening, what life is like for these young women that are caught up in it or held in it. And so I found Kay Buck, the executive director of the Coalition Against Slavery and Trafficking. And Kay is joining us now to talk about all this. Kay, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to talk with you. Read a lot about, you know, what you guys are doing, and I think it's going to be important for people to understand this, and I think you're perfect people to do this. So let's jump into it. What exactly is, just as a start, I don't think people really get the immensity or even the full meaning of human trafficking. So why don't we start off by just saying to people, what is human trafficking and what makes it modern day slavery?
Well, human trafficking is when someone, man, woman, or child, is held through force or fraud or some type of coercion in forced labor or in the commercial sex trade. So a lot of people don't realize that there's human trafficking that happens in the motel or restaurant industry, in agriculture. It's both forced labor as well as sex trafficking.
The other thing that I think people don't really get, I know for me it was like sort of a real shock to see the scope of this, just how huge it is. Tell people about that a little bit.
Well, it is huge. I mean, this is a global criminal enterprise, and the current statistics is that it's over a $30 billion industry. So it's very profit-driven, and it impacts so many women and men and girls here and all over the world. Now, what might surprise your listeners is that Los Angeles is actually a magnet where traffickers bring victims because they can easily hide them in such a large city. In addition to that, we serve a growing domestic population, meaning they are American, usually kids and young adults, who are trafficked by pimps or traffickers into the commercial sex trade in Los Angeles. So what we have in Los Angeles is a mixture of a whole lot of forced labor in the industries I just mentioned, as well as young adults and kids being trafficked into the commercial sex trade.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to actually, you know, get my head around this because I'd like to know both adults and children, how do they get into this in the first place? What actually, you know, are they just like picked up off the street or what? How does this happen?
That's a great question, Michael, because it's really about recruitment. So what happens, and, you know, every case is somewhat different, but the common theme is that both adults and children are somehow recruited. Sometimes the trafficker does the recruiting him or herself, or they hire recruiters to do that work for them. Now, this happens in both trafficking in a foreign national context, where they're sending recruiters like foreign labor brokers into communities abroad where people are vulnerable, meaning they want to find better opportunities to support themselves and their families. And so a recruiter will go in, you know, driving a nice car, wearing nice clothes, and say, you know, send your daughter or your son with me, and they'll get a great education. They can send money home so that the rest of your children, the siblings, can go to school. You can put food on the table for your family. And so that's how they convince this family or this person to recruit their daughter or their son, or sometimes even themselves. Now, in a domestic context, it is similar, where we usually work with young adults or kids where they are running from something. It might be not such a great family environment, and sometimes it's a regular middle-class family where they are befriended by a man online in social media, and they agree to meet, and this man romances them into thinking that it's a romantic relationship. And it ends up being one of exploitation and severe abuse. But always, in every single case, there is an element of recruitment where they are persuading or duping the victim into thinking that they're going to have a better life or a better situation.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read somewhere that sex trafficking is highest in the poorest and most unstable countries in the world, and that extreme poverty is often the common bond among victims. Is that similar to what you're saying?
Absolutely. Poverty is definitely a factor. So you have to remember that traffickers and their foreign labor recruiters that they use, they hone in or they prey upon vulnerability. And when they're targeting certain communities, they're really looking at who needs the money in order to support their families or themselves. So absolutely, poverty plays a huge role in how people are vulnerable to trafficking in the first place. But I do want to point out, Michael, too, that this happens in India. This happens in Thailand. I worked for several years in Thailand many years ago, and that was definitely a common theme where people were so impoverished that the traffickers would go in and tell them, I have this great opportunity for you in the city, you know, in Bangkok, or sometimes they would say in Los Angeles or New York, and then people would go with them thinking that this is the chance of a lifetime to really change their lives, when in fact they're just being duped by the trafficker or their intermediary, the foreign labor brokers.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Kay Buck, the executive director of the Coalition Against Slavery and Trafficking, and we're talking about the trafficking in human lives, both for work and for sexual exploitation. Kay, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, you know, I was stunned when I read the numbers involved in this, that 30 million people are enslaved around the world approximately. And there's huge numbers that keep happening every year. And I was just curious about that, the mammoth size of it. Talk about the scope of this a little bit and how much of that involves adults and how much involves children.
Right. Well, it does. It impacts both adults and children. And in our cases here in Los Angeles, we see the majority being young adults, like a transition age youth population. So anywhere from the age of 18 to 28 or 29 years of age. So the scope, however, is much larger than most people think. And the reason is that up until recently, it really wasn't talked about, which is great that you're covering this on your program today. So, as I said earlier, Los Angeles is a magnet for trafficking when traffickers bring victims from all over the world. In fact, at CAST, my organization, we've served people from over 59 countries who've been trafficked from usually developing countries into Los Angeles for forced labor or the commercial sex trade.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you this because I think it's important for people to get a visceral sense of this as well as sort of an intellectual and analytical sense of it. What actually does it mean for someone to be held as a sex slave, and in particular, what it means for a young girl? You know, you watch the film that I know you're going to be speaking on the panel tonight, the film Sold, and you really get a visceral sense of what life is like for this young girl that gets basically kidnapped and sold into a, you know, sexual enslavement. Tell people a little bit about what actually, give them a sense of what it means to be held as a sex slave.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's important to point out again that Usually it's a process of recruitment. Not many of our cases involve kidnapping. Some are kidnapped, so it does happen, but the vast majority of our cases are situations where traffickers or their intermediaries are very savvy and persuade people to come with them for a better opportunity. So I think it's important to point it out, that to point that out, that recruitment plays a very important role here. And I can talk about some legislation that we got passed 2 years ago to address this. But the life of someone who's trafficked into the commercial sex trade is horrific, as you can imagine. So young girls or young adults, both men and women, are recruited. Many times they are seeing upwards of 20, 30 clients a day. And if they don't make a quota, they are severely beaten. So in our sex trafficking cases, there tends to be a whole lot of violence, physical violence, but also a lot of emotional and psychological violence. So you can imagine the complex trauma that we see when victims come to us for help. So, I mean, I don't know if that answers your question, but sometimes girls or women are trafficked or enslaved for a few months. Some are enslaved for 12, 13 years before they are able to escape. But, you know, I think it's important to point out that the days of girls or women being chained to beds or being isolated from anyone else, that's not generally how trafficking happens anymore. So there are times, like potential interventions that could happen if we raise more awareness in the community. And that's why this film is so great. It's being used to raise awareness among the community, because you might be surprised to know that most of our referrals actually come from Good Samaritans or neighbors, taxi drivers, people who think, this isn't right, something's wrong here, I'm going to call this organization and they can check it out. So I think it's important to point out that trafficking, modern slavery and human trafficking, has some modern elements, and that is that we do have opportunity for intervention.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that struck me both in the film and as you're talking and some of the research I was doing in preparing for this is that there is an overriding factor in trafficking that really just sort of jumped out at me, and that's that part of what happens is that there's a culture internationally, no matter where you are, there's a culture that says that the lives of women and girls are expendable. It's important that somebody can actually see through that and say, no, this isn't right. But it seems like there's also a need to recognize that there is this culture that says women's lives don't mean anything in this world. And that allows, it opens up the door for a lot of what we're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a gender-based crime, although it does happen to men and boys as well. So I think the common theme is really vulnerability. And in many societies, for a lot of reasons, but one being gender discrimination and violence against women and girls are often targeted. Currently, about 75% of our cases are women and girls, and 25% are men and boys. So throughout our history, and we're 18 years old as an organization here in Los Angeles, without exception, every year the majority of our clients are women and girls. So absolutely, this is a gender-based crime. Now, I can give you examples where when a foreign labor recruiter goes into a community and targets maybe one of the daughters, saying to the family, you know, let your daughter come with me, and that way she can work and send money home so that her brothers can go to school. So there's always this element of favoring boys over the girls.
What does your organization do in relation to all this?
Well, CAST is the largest service provider to survivors or victims of human trafficking in the country. As I said earlier, we've served victims from over 59 countries, including survivors who are American citizens being trafficked mostly in the commercial sex trade. In addition to that, what we do is what we learn from our cases in working so closely with survivors we inform public policy. So we pass laws such as a law that now regulates foreign labor brokers as a way to prevent trafficking from happening in the first place. So, you know, I think it's really important as we learn about how trafficking happens internationally and locally, that we use that information, that data, to inform better laws.
Mm-hmm. I do want to return to just one question. It sort of goes back to the question that we were talking about earlier about in terms of the extreme poverty and the rest of this and how people get pulled into this. You know, and there's that whole idea about women's lives being expendable. It seems that even if women do somehow get a chance to escape or they get free of all this somehow, that even then, if they return to like their villages in some of the third world countries or anywhere, even here, there's an assessment made, there's a judgment made that, well, they must have done something to be there, or they're not worthy of being in the village anymore. They're not worthy, or they're sort of like seen as bringing this on themselves. How frequent is that, and what do you think of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a huge taboo, and as a result, many of our clients, survivors, choose to stay in the country, meaning stay in the United States and integrate into the community here, rather than go back home to their home country. And the reason is twofold. One is safety. The trafficker is usually either some type of community leader or has ties to the leaders of that community. So reintegrating back into their own community is next to impossible for safety, but also for the reasons we just discussed, that there's such a taboo so that when they do return, they're seen as bringing it on themselves. So as a result, most of the survivors of sex trafficking and even labor trafficking as well, who are trafficked into Los Angeles, they decide to stay here. And we're able to help them through legal remedies, through the Trafficking Victims and Protection Act, which is a national law that allows for immigration remedies for survivors of trafficking.
All right, Kay Buck, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again soon. We'll have to follow up on this.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. That was Kay Buck, CEO and Executive Director of the Coalition Against Slavery and Trafficking, talking about the scope and impact of the human trafficking of 30 million people around the world. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Bob Avakian and a clip from his film, BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And this clip is on the oppression of women bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution.
Which side are you on,
yeah,
boy? Which side are
the
you on?
The silence is unappreciated.
Which side are
I'm gonna go ahead and take this disrespect.
Which side are you on?
Silence is death,
Lord.
Yes.
Which side are you on?
Get off the fence, son.
Which side are you on?
Get off the bench, son.
Which side are you
who
on?
Who stands to defend us? Against us,
we drawing a line in the sand. You with us or against us, gotta decide where you stand. There's an angel and a demon inside of every man. It's completely up to you, getting the upper hand.
Which side are
I make
you
music
on,
for the people. Survival got a ruthless, we confusing.
All right, welcome back. That was Which Side Are You On? And it's Talib Kweli and Ninth Wonder. All right, now we're going to be listening to a clip from the film BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And it's Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, speaking on the oppression of women bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution.
Now, earlier I spoke to the fact that the division of society into masters and slaves, into different classes, developed together with the oppression of women. These were very tightly bound together in their historical development and have remained so throughout the course of history since that time through different kinds of societies. And today we can see the ways in which the oppression of women, not just in a particular country, but on a world scale, continues to feed the functioning of this capitalist imperialist system. Not only, as I pointed out, is it highly profitable in the billions and billions of dollars to oppress women in sex trafficking, prostitution, and pornography, but also the backward conditions that are maintained and enforced by the functioning and the military power of the imperialist countries throughout the third world lead to a situation where many women are outcast and desperate and highly vulnerable to being exploited in this vast network of sweatshops that is at the foundation of imperialist capital in the world today. know, I think of the phenomenon of people standing in line for the latest gadget from Apple. And I have to say, it makes me mad. I say to myself, what the f*** is the matter with you people? You can stand in line overnight for the latest gadget from Apple, but you can't stand up to oppose wars and torture and mass incarceration and the degradation of women. What the hell is the matter with you people? Now, to be clear, those people standing in line are not the enemy. But what is represented by Apple, and not just Apple unto itself, but the whole system and the network of exploitation that Apple is a part of and enmeshed in, is what needs to be swept aside. I mean, when you're at the end of the food chain in a country like this, living parasitically, even if you're not in the ruling class, off of people all over the world, once again, sometimes all this can be hidden from you. You do not see the blood and the bones, the worn down fingers and other body parts of particularly women who are working in the plants in places like China, making the components that go into the Apple products and all these other things under horrific conditions. You do not see the people in Bangladesh making many of the clothes that you're wearing. And when you leave here and go home tonight, look in your closet and see how many of your clothes you can find are not made in the third world, and you can be sure if they are made in places like Bangladesh, Haiti, Pakistan, or whatever, that they're made through a lot of child labor and in any case extreme conditions of sweatshop exploitation. But we do not, the products don't come with this stamped on them. You don't pick up an iPhone, press a button, and the blood of the women who made it comes gushing out. But it's there, even though you can't see it. And imperialism feasts on this. Don't let them fool you with their talk about microloans. Let's have some microloans for poor women in the third world so they can set up a business and exploit other women and then, in their large numbers, fail anyway. This is not what the imperialist system is doing. This is a tiny countercurrent to the massive exploitation on which of these very kinds of women on which this system rests. And look at this country. Not only is there the great value to imperialist capital of super exploitation of women in the third world, but in this country it's a fact that the social relations that oppress women are critical for holding together this whole oppressive system, which has historically evolved with male domination, a key foundation of the whole system, a foundation stone built into its whole structure. Think about the family and how people live and reproduce in this society. Everything in this society is based on commodity production and exchange. You don't have little groups of people all making overwhelmingly the things they need and then using them themselves. There's vast networks of exploitation in this country, but increasingly in other parts of the world, producing all these things. And then you have to get some means by working in some way or other to have the basis of to have the commodity money to go buy these things. That's the way the economy works. And all of it gets funneled through the what these reactionaries are always reminding us is the basic unit and cell of this society, the family. And the whole family has evolved historically with women being subordinate to men and having as one part of that the prime responsibility for the domestic aspect of things, including the rearing of children and things like just doing the everyday work of the house. And there have been some changes in this society. More women in the professions, more women going to college, more women working in a lot of ways. And all this has put tremendous strains on these oppressive relations, but it hasn't broken them because this system cannot do without these relations. And so you have this tremendous potential eruption where the changes in the economy are straining against the limitations of the oppression of women and other exploitative and oppressive relations, but the system cannot do without them. Now, as one illustration of this, I was reading an article in the New York Times about a phenomenon in the South where some of these men who had fairly good paying industrial jobs, once again the phenomenon, the companies closed down, move the factories away, the men are out of work, the women are going out and getting the jobs and service and whatever that are available to them that they can get, but the men are largely sitting on their couches, drinking their beer and moping. And one of the authors of this article asked one of these men, well, why don't you go out and get one of these jobs that these women are doing? He said, no, I can't do that. It's not man's work. I just wouldn't feel like a man if I had a job like that. This captures a lot about the contradictions of this system and how it's intensifying. And in reading this, I was thinking about what Engels wrote in The Origin of the Family, Private Property in the State. And talking about the Roman Empire, Engels, who along with Marx founded the communist movement. He was talking about agriculture in the declining period of the Roman Empire, that it had been based on slave plantations called latifundia. But as the Roman Empire went into decline, the plantations, the slave plantations, the latifundia became less and less profitable. And so they broke down and people had to go back into small-scale farming. But all of the former slave owners, or almost all of them, wouldn't go back and do actual farm work, even though the plantations were no longer profitable, because they considered it beneath their dignity to do that kind of work. And Engels pointed out, this contributed to the decline and weakening of Rome and made it more and more vulnerable to the barbarians that were increasingly at the gate and battering at the gate. And I was thinking about these men saying, I can't do that. It's not man's work. It doesn't make me feel like a man. How this represents a straining of the changes have brought about, straining against the oppressive relations. And I was thinking about how, in parallel to Rome, how this could also contribute to the further declining and weakening of this oppressive system and make it more vulnerable to the barbarians, namely us. Now, the oppression of women and all the horrors bound up with it can be ended and something radically different and emancipating brought into being. Now, let's be honest. To many, especially many women, this may not seem possible and, frankly, hard to believe. But that is not only because of the way things are now and the way so many men act so much of the time. But more fundamentally, because of the way things are now, sets a certain framework and tone for people's thinking. Because the possibility of radical change cannot be seen to the degree that our vision and our sense of reality and of possibility is still confined within, conditioned by, and filtered through the dominating relations that are at the foundation of this whole system. And the traditions, values, ways of being and of thinking that constantly pour forth from and serve to perpetuate this system that we are forced to live under. In this way, they get us twice. Their system embodies and enforces all this horrific oppression, and it has people believing that this cannot be done away with. But the truth, which they try every way to keep people from seeing, is that we can be rid of this horrific oppression. But we can't do this by accepting the terms of this system or any part of its oppression. We can't do it half-stepping and halfway. That is why Basics 322 makes it very clear. You cannot break all the chains except one. You cannot say you want to be free of exploitation and oppression except you want to keep the oppression of women by men. You can't say you want to liberate humanity yet keep one half of humanity enslaved to the other half. The oppression of women is completely bound up with the division of society into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, and the ending of all such conditions is impossible without the complete liberation of women. All this is why women have a tremendous role to play, not only in making revolution, but in making sure there is all the way revolution. The fury of women can and must be fully unleashed as a mighty force for proletarian revolution. And as this statement is also emphasizing, the fight against the oppression of women and for all the way revolution is not just their fight. It is a fight that must be fully and vigorously taken up by men as well, by everyone who really wants to see an end to this system and all the horrors it means for the masses of humanity. Everyone who wants to see an end to the long night in which humanity has been divided into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, who wants to see a dawning of a new day for humanity. The only people who should fear and not join in with this unleashed fury of women are those who have a real stake in this system and want to keep it going with everything it does to people.
That was Bob Avakian, or BA, on the oppression of women bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution. This is taking from his film, which is available on a DVD, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. To find out more about BA, go to revcom.us and click on the Bob Avakian section. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my guests, Robert Mirapol, Kay Buck, and Bob Avakian. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Alex Brenner, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And don't forget, if you want to work on the show, help out in any way, write to us and let us know. And I guarantee that we'll be able to find a way to plug you in. All right, we're going out now with Harriet Tubman's Gonna Carry Me Home. And that's from the Long Riders. Talk to you again next week.
This is off Two-Fisted Tales. This is called Harriet Tubman's Gonna Carry Me Home.
Well, I left my man on the other side. Harriet Tubman's gonna carry me home. On the Underground Railroad I will ride. Harriet Tubman's gonna carry me home. At night I ride on the Northern Star. Harriet Tubman's gonna carry me home. If I've gotta go to heaven, then I'll go that far. Harriet Tubman's gonna carry me home. Well, they say that old Dred Scott put his hooks on me. Well, they made the shackles that'll keep me from wrestling free. Well, I left my man on the other side. Harriet Tubman's gonna carry me home. On the Underground Railroad he will ride. Harriet Tubman's gonna carry me home. And there's more of him like there's more of me. Harriet Tubman's gonna carry me home.